So as I mentioned earlier, this talk is called The Problems of Comparing. This is a topic I've spoken about before in this group, as a matter of fact, I think several years ago. And it came back to me how important this topic was three or four weeks ago, sitting out there listening to someone else give a Dharma talk. And in as this person was giving the Dharma talk, they mispronounced a couple of Pali words. And my mind immediately went to this place of comparing. Like, oh, this person can't even pronounce the Pali words correctly, blah, 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 blah. And I started the little rant. I was in a little rant state for a while. And comparing myself, my talks are way better, I understand the Pali, blah, blah, blah. It's like, luckily I could see this happening, so it wasn't like, but it was incredible how distracting it was from me actually being able to pay attention to the Dharma talk, because I was caught in this comparing loop. So that reminded me of this topic, and so when David asked me to speak, about a week later, he asked me to speak tonight. I said, oh, I know exactly what I need to talk about. And so I wanted to talk about this thing called the problems of comparing. And I want to start by reading something, a brief one piece of a longer thing from the Samyutta Nikaya. Samyutta Nikaya means the collected teachings. And so this is a collection of Buddhist teachings where all the particular teachings about a specific topic that the Buddha gave are all collected in one place. And this particular little piece I'm going to read comes from something with the topic of the five aggregates of clinging, which is probably one of the biggest topics the Buddha ever talked about. I'm not going to go into great detail about this, other than to say in the Samyutta Nikaya, this is the one that has 159 different teachings. So this is a pretty important topic, somehow, from the volume he spoke of this stuff. This is one little piece of this. When anyone, on the basis of form, which is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, regards themselves thus, I am superior, or I am inferior, or I am equal. What is that due to apart from not seeing things as they really are? That's an interesting statement, huh? When anyone, on the basis of form, which is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, regards themselves thus, I am superior, or I am inferior, or I am equal. What does that do to apart from not seeing things as they really are? Like, duh, what's wrong with you for thinking this way? You know? The five aggregates of clinging are a way the Buddha describes everything we experience, all phenomena, and breaks it into these five piles. Yeah, and the word aggregate is sometimes actually means a heap or a pile. And the Buddha says everything we experience is in these one of these five piles. And the four verses after this verse go through the other four piles and say it's the same thing for all of them. Basically, what he's saying is, by thinking we're superior or inferior or equal, and I'll come to that part, or equal, we are creating a sense of separate self. We're creating this of me, not me. That's how we do it. This is the main way we do it, is by comparing. And so it seems to me that this might be an important topic, like to understand how we actually create this sense of separate self over and over and over and over and over again in our habitual patterns of comparing mind. This is often called conceit in other translations. Instead of comparing mind, just talk about in a lot of the Buddhist teachings, he talks about the problems of conceit. This conceit meaning this conceit that you're separate. That's very conceited to think that you're a separate individual. Other translations might be pride, arrogance, or measuring. It's also interestingly called one of the latent torments. I think it's great, right? Latent torments. That means it isn't something that's obvious. It's something that it seems kind of like normal, natural. Well, of course, we're always comparing ourselves to other people. It's like healthy to compare yourself to others. You know, that's the cultural belief we have, that somehow it's normal. So it's something that's sort of underneath, it's a layer underneath what we normally even pay attention to. It's a latent torment. They're the hard ones to get rid of, by the way, the latent ones. So there's these three modes, better than, worse than, equal to. So let's look at those three modes and see what's the problem here. Basically, if you're thinking that you are better than someone, some individual, or some group of people, or some class of people, like, I'm better than those people who voted for him, or I'm better than the people who didn't vote for him, for that matter. I mean, you can think of that either way. Or, however you want to blame somebody about something or praise somebody about something. But as soon as I'm like, I can very quickly fall into this mode of thinking I'm better than somebody because they did something or they wear those funny hats or whatever it is, however it is when you think about it. We immediately create that sense of us and them. We separate ourselves. As soon as I think I'm superior to someone else, I create this sense of separation. And, you know, it can be on other things other than I was talking in the political sense, but it could also be like, well, I'm better than those people who don't meditate. What's wrong with them? If we all meditated, the world would be just fine, right? That's Buddhist conceit. But it's all the same. We all go to those places all the time. I want to read you something that the Dalai Lama says about this, because I think when I read this, I went, this is what I... So. This is the Dalai Lama talking about his daily life, in a sense. Because when I meet someone, I always try to relate to the person on the basic human level. On that level, I know that, just like me, he or she wishes to find happiness, to have fewer problems and less difficulty in their life. Whether I am speaking with one person or whether I am giving a talk to a large group of people, I will see myself first and foremost as just another fellow human. That way, there is in fact no need for introduction. If, on the other hand, I relate to them from the perspective of myself as someone different, a Buddhist, a Tibetan, and so on, I will then create walls to keep me apart from others. And if I relate to them to others thinking that I am the Dalai Lama, I will create the basis for my own separation and loneliness. After all, there's only one Dalai Lama in the entire world. In contrast, if I see myself primarily in terms of myself as a fellow human, I will then have more than 7 billion people who I can feel deep connection with. And this is wonderful, isn't it? What do you need to fear or worry about when you have 7 billion other people who are with you? It's such a great attitude to take. Just that he's just, I mean, talk about not a regular guy who thinks he's a regular guy. Right? And he is. That's the beauty of the Dalai Lama, I think, is that he can be very sort of like normal in some sense. My favorite picture of the Dalai Lama is he was in Boston to give a talk at the big arena there, you know, the big, and he went in the morning just to sort of, you know, see the place and get a tour and that sort of thing. Well, this is where the Boston Bruins play hockey, right? And the Bruins were practicing that morning. So here's all these hulking guys and, you know, these big uniforms with pads and everything. And he's sort of watching them, you know, and getting a little explanation of what's going on. And the guys get really excited. The Dalai Lama's there. And they come over and they give him a Boston Bruins baseball cap. And what does he do? He puts it on right away and stands next to one of the guys and gets his picture taken with him. This is like a regular guy, right? But at the same time, I mean, he was just relating to these hockey players who are like, talk about different than a Dalai Lama, a hockey player. Anyhow, I love that way of thinking that he has. These sensations of separation create our own suffering. As soon as I separate myself, I create the causes and conditions that suffering will arise. And then when I speak and act from that place, I can cause the suffering of others. As soon as I separate myself and think of myself as better than someone else, and then act and speak from that space, it's bound to create suffering. This is where all the trouble in the world comes from, often just from this simple problem, this idea of comparing all the time. It's also, I was talking earlier on tonight about the Brahma Viharas. You know, we talk about, and there's two in particular, compassion. Well, when I think I'm better than somebody else, I'm no longer experiencing compassion. I'm experiencing pity, which is called the near enemy of compassion. It's me looking down at those poor people. I've separated myself. My heart is no longer connected to them at all. This is what we do all the time if we're not careful. Okay, so that's better than. So you can see better than has some problems, right? Worse than. This is how basically we constantly beat ourselves up. This is like one of the biggest problems in Western culture is the problem of not believing in ourselves, in having this sense of there's always something wrong with me. Yeah. The primary source of this worse than comparing habit is doubt. Doubt is one of the five kalesas, the five obstructions to mindfulness that the Buddha talks about. I think it's the second biggest collection in the Samyutta Nikaya, actually. And it's that energy of, I can't do this. I'm not good enough. Oh, those other people, they can go on a long retreat, but I'm not wise enough, pure enough, ready enough to go on a retreat. And this is how we always fall into this one. And it's partly because, as I said, it's a cultural thing. Like, our culture actually encourages us to think this way. Basically, I used to be in marketing and public relations in my businessman days way back then. And the whole idea of every advertising you ever saw was, if you don't have this, you're not good enough. Smart enough, cool enough, sexy enough, whatever enough, but you're not enough. So we're bombarded in our culture by this energy and this way of thinking all the time. And, well, so of course we fall into it. This is what holds us back from deepening our practice. This is how we create our own suffering again. It's like we hold ourselves back because we think we're not ready, we're not good enough, I'm not there yet. Which is just comparing to some mythical self that might be better, or actually comparing yourself to some other person who you see sitting there, and you know, you see someone sitting and they're sitting very quietly and they're very still, and your mind's going, oh boy, they're a serious practitioner, right? They're really, you know, that person could be sitting there totally lost in fantasy for the entire 40 minutes of the sit. And you'd never know, because they happen to be able to sit very quietly while they fantasize. But that's all. So it's like we have no, it's just, we make these things up. This is also related to the near enemy of metta, which is wanting something more. We want to be better, to see ourselves as better than we think we are. We can't accept ourselves as we are. This is also a source for the entire self-help book industry. This energy that our culture is imbued with, saturated with. I used to have this great list of all the crazy titles for self-help books. I didn't bring it tonight. But it's like, it's just such a huge industry. When you go into any sort of bookstore or library, and there's like rows and rows and rows of these books. That if you read this book, you'll get better. You'll be better because, you know, who knows. So that's the second layer of these three modes of comparing. So the third mode is equal to. And when I first came across this, I went, well, wait a second. What's wrong with equal to? I mean, this is America, right? Yeah. All men are created equal. It's right there in, you know, the preamble to the Constitution, or I think that's where it is anyway. One of those places, important places anyway. It's like it's deeply imbued in our cultural view of ourselves, is that we're all for equality. And that anybody can succeed. And to be honest with you, I really bought into this belief when I was younger and for many years after I was younger. I come from a really basic working class background. I worked my way through university. My parents didn't have any money. I mean, they couldn't afford to send me, so I actually worked my way through college. I don't know if people can still do that, but back in 60s when I did that, it was still possible. And I sort of, after I got out of college, I got a job, and then I got a better job, and then I did this, and I did that, and, you know, I was a successful businessman, I suppose, you could say. And it was like, you know, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, you know, that thing of, and then because I could do that, well, anybody can do that, because we're all equal, right? I absolutely believe that was true. That if I could do that, anyone can do that. But as I started to wake up a little bit, became a little more woke, I realized how advantaged I am. How those advantages that I sort of took for granted, didn't even think about, made it easy for me to bootstrap. White, tall, male, straight. Keep going down the list. You know, I was actually happened to be kind of smart. You know, I had all these incredible advantages that were just like I took for granted. I mean, I thought, you know, there I was on third base already, and I thought I got there by hitting a triple, right? But actually, I was born on third base. And a lot of people are born out there in the dugout someplace, and they might even not have ever get a chance to get up the bat, let alone get a hit and maybe even get to first base. And there I was on third base going, well, everybody can get here. I did it. We're not equal at all. World is incredibly unequal. And so when we fall into that everyone's equal trap, we separate ourselves right away from all those who are less advantaged than us. We are living in this incredible country. I mean, it's got problems, this country, but relatively speaking, We live in the land of luxury. We have so much advantage here compared to, say, someone born in Sri Lanka or Myanmar or pick your third world country. It's incredible how much we have that we just take for granted. You know, we turn on the tap and clean water comes out. That's normal, right? Well, of course, you turn on the tap and clean water. Though if you live in Flint, that's not true anymore. But I mean, but generally speaking, we sort of take these things for granted. There's this equal myth that our culture supports and encourages us to believe in and think. Causes yet another cause for suffering. And it just isn't true in many, many ways. It's comforting to think that way, though, isn't it? It's like we're all in the same boat. We all have the same opportunity. We're all, everything's the same. It's kind of like, I like that thought. But the fact is, I've got a yacht and some people have a leaky dinghy. We're not in the same boat at all. Absolutely not in the same boat at all. So that's the three different modes and the issues that arise out of those three modes. But the underlying issue I want to come back to in all of these modes is as soon as I compare, even comparing equal to, I separate myself. I become me and them, me and not me. I create a sense of separation. It falls directly out of the act of comparing, the mental process of comparing, the mind state of comparing is one where we create the sense of a separate self. And this, I mean, if in the Buddhist teachings, this is the big problem. You know, the biggest problem. I mean, when the Buddha talks about his moment of enlightenment, and he said, the last thing he let go of, the last thing he had to let go of before he became enlightened, sitting there under the Bodhi tree, was a small sense of separate self. That was the last thing that had to go. So this isn't, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's like, oh, well, we just all forget about being a separate self and everything will be fine. But this is central to what the Buddha taught. This is the most difficult idea to grasp of all of the Buddha's teachings. It certainly is for me, speaking very personally. This is the one that I struggle with a lot still. I'm not like, oh, well, I got this one. I'm just going to tell you guys about it now. I wish I could, but I don't. So anyhow, so I want to read another piece here. This is from Majjhima Nikaya. And this is the Buddha talking about this topic from a slightly different angle, but certainly very precisely. And the Buddha often taught in sort of the call-response mode. You know, he'd say something and then the bhikkhus would answer back. And he'd, you know. So this is one of those examples of him teaching in call-response. Bhikkhus, what do you think? Is material form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, venerable sir. And he goes through the other four aggregates of clinging, repeating the same form. Therefore, bhikkhus, any kind of material form whatever, whether past, future, or present, all material form should be seen as it actually is without prop- with proper wisdom thus: this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And once again, it repeats it for the other four. Seeing thus, a well-taught, noble disciple becomes disenchanted with material form, disenchanted with feeling, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with formations, disenchanted with consciousness. Those are the five. Being disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge it is liberated. He understands birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There's no more coming to any state of being. He's basically saying, understand this, and this is how liberation arises. This is this form that I read. You'll find exactly the same form with slightly variations of topic sometimes, but the same sort of call-response, repetitive teaching and leading to liberation, leading to what this practice is all about. I mean, this is a practice. This is the practice of liberation. We sometimes forget that, but this is what this practice is. It's a way of shifting our consciousness. And I want to be very careful here. I don't want to make liberation sound like an on-off switch. Every time we catch ourselves comparing and go, oh, there I am comparing again, that's a moment of liberation. Right there. We just experienced a moment of liberation when we saw ourselves, oh, I'm caught in that comparing mind again. And if we do that more often and more often and more often, that leads us towards liberation, complete liberation. So it's not like an on-off switch. It's a very, very gradual process, but we can consciously choose to cultivate the understanding and then practice. And by practicing, we can then see, oh, look, there I am in that old comparing story again. And then I can actually make that conscious choice to not go there. Okay. So, there's another interesting list here that I want to go through. And this is the sources, the causes and conditions that cause comparing to arise. These are areas that we habitually compare in. We compare ourselves to others based on these areas of thinking. And there's four of them: birth, wisdom, wealth, and appearance. When the Buddha talked about birth, he was referring, because of the culture he lived in at the time, to the caste system that was in India at that time. And it still is to a certain extent. I mean, people say it's not there, and legally it's not there, but believe me, it's still there. And the caste system basically, you know, based on which caste you were in, you had certain rights and privileges. If you were a Brahmin, then you got to be rich, and you got to be a teacher, and you got to learn Sanskrit and do all the teaching. And if you were a Sudra, then you worked in some field all your life, probably for a Brahmin who owned the land. And some people who fell outside became untouchable, and they were even poor. So it was a very rigid class system. And so when the Buddha talked about birth, he was talking about the fact that we sometimes compare ourselves to others based on just the fact that we were born in a certain place. You see this a lot in this country. Yeah. I was born in the United States. I was born here. I'm not one of those immigrants. How often do we see that these days in our culture? I'm better because I'm an American, and America is the best country in the world. How often do we hear that spouted by politicians? Of course, it's complete nonsense. I mean, I hate to tell you that, but it's true. You know, if you look at any of the studies about the United States in terms of best place to live and best healthcare systems and best this, they're like, we're down like 15, 16, 13, like way, way, way below where a lot of other countries are. But there's this cultural idea that to be an American is the best thing to be. And that's how I compare myself to others. I'm an American and they're not Americans, therefore I'm better. It's like deeply embedded in our culture. And it causes an incredible amount of suffering. Just by us holding those beliefs. Also, because we hold those beliefs, we sometimes don't understand how difficult it is for other people who weren't born here but live here now, who are immigrants either legally or illegally, how difficult their lives are. And we're seeing more and more of that because it's being reported more and more. But believe me, it's not. If you're not an American and you live in this country, it's not very nice. It's really difficult. And we lose touch of that because we get caught in the, but I'm an American. Therefore, I'm good. I'm okay. I'm one of those. So that's one place we compare all the time. Wisdom, the next one. We feel if we're better educated, then somehow we're better than those people who are less educated. It's a very common belief. Welcome to Boulder, by the way. I had a birthday party when I was 60. I had about 20 people that I looked around the room, and over half the people in the room had PhDs, and about five of the other 10 people had master's degrees. I was like one of those poor people who only had a bachelor's degree. And this is like Boulder. This is what Boulder's like in a lot of ways. You know? And we get caught in this idea of like, it's better because we're smarter. Or I know all about the Dharma. I know all about the Buddhist teachings and those other people don't. It's another form of wisdom. I'm better than them. Then you get the sort of the flip side of this as well in comparing. People can feel that those people who are highly educated can be kind of snobbish. You know, they think they're the elite. Here we go into politics pretty quickly again, if I'm not careful. Right? They aren't like me. I'm just like a working class guy. The elite don't understand what it's like to be a real American. And I'm still falling to sometimes because of my working class blue collar background. I still find myself thinking like this sometimes. It's fascinating, like, where does that come from? It's like, well, because that's how I grew up. Yeah. I grew up like going on vacation and coming back from vacation would be all going through all of our clothes and shaking out the clothes to find the change to get the gas to get home. That was how I thought was like normal. It was just, I had a great life. I'm not saying my life wasn't wonderful. I had a wonderful childhood, a loving two-parent family, had a great time. But it was like very poor working class people. Wealth. Here's another way we compare. Ah, yeah, this is a good one. Richer is better. Or, of course, richer is worse. We see this is a lot going on in the culture these days. Because those rich people are so greedy. Or poor people are bad. They're poor because they're lazy. once again, you know, I'm proud of my working class roots. It makes me more real. Like I understand what it's like to struggle and gone through that American thing. The poor people in Boulder are pretty much invisible. Have you noticed that? I mean, other than you see some people, you know, panhandling, they're not, you don't actually, you know, almost it's like, well, we don't have poor people in Boulder, do we? You'd be surprised how much poverty there is right here in this town. I work as a chaplain at the hospital part-time. And a lot of the people who end up in hospital are people who are so poor they don't have good health care and never had good health care. There's an incredible amount of poverty right here in Boulder County. It's invisible. It's hidden away. But it's there. And we just don't want it. We don't see it anymore. Also, if you go to any of the state-supported health facilities for people who are disabled. People like Vista View and Boulder Manor. If you ever visited those places, it's horrible. I mean, how these people are literally warehoused in these institutions because they just, simply for the fact they don't have any money. That's the only reason they're there. They're sick. They're disabled. They have no money. We'll put them in this place. It's and the thinking behind that is, you know, if you're wealthy, you deserve to be in one of these upscale, fancy retirement home places. Otherwise, we put you in one of these places. I spent a long time doing hospice work, and so I spent a lot of time sitting with people dying in places like Vista View and Boulder Manor. And it was never pretty. And then I'd go sit with someone in the Carillon, which is very upscale. And it was like the luxury way to die. But it's totally arbitrary. Totally arbitrary. Now here's the last way we would compare, right? Appearance. The whole aspect of concept of physical beauty, young, fit, well, in Boulder, very fit, white, blonde, tall. These are all sort of like the cultural norms of what it means. And if you aren't those things, then you're just not as good. You're not as perfect, as beautiful, as wonderful, as whatever, you know, language you want to use. You see this in our love of fashion in clothes, fashionable clothes. I mean, it's like the prices of fashionable clothes. If you look at, I have a friend who works as a model. It's astounding to me. You know, this is just like a t-shirt or something, right? But it's a fashion t-shirt. And all of a sudden, this t-shirt, instead of being $15, is $300. Maybe the cotton's nicer, tighter weave or something, you know, but it's just a t-shirt. But it has the label on it that says it's special. And that's that appearance comparing game. We also get caught in this appearance comparing world when we see people who are culturally dressing different, the hijab issue, for instance. You know, it's like for a lot of people, they see a woman wearing a hijab and it's like, oh my God. She's like that. She's one of those oppressed Muslim women. Blah, 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 as far as I'm concerned. But that's where people go. They compare in that way as that's what they label her and stick her in that bucket. Just because she happens to be wearing this headscarf. People have difficulty with people who seem androgynous for the same sort of reasons. Like, I can't fit this person into my one or the other world. And that makes me kind of uncomfortable. And I compare myself. They're kind of weird. That's just us. That's just us comparing again. So these are all the ways we compare. These are the issues around when we compare, right? There was the whole thing of birth. I was born in the right place, you weren't. Value of wisdom, I'm smart, you're not. Or you think you're smart, and that makes you a snob, because you know, a lot of things work both ways. You know, I moved here from Canada, and I have Canadian friends still who think, you moved to the United States and you took out citizenship there? What's wrong with you? It's like they can't believe I instead of being a Canadian and now I'm an American. And it's like, I must be crazy. So it works both ways, that way too. Wealth and appearance. And these are all, you know, I was talking earlier about how normal this idea of comparing seems. It's like, well, yeah, of course, it's just the way things are. It's what we do. That's why it's called a latent torment. It's so deeply embedded in us culturally, among other ways, that it just seems normal. But this, every time we compare, we're creating our own suffering and the suffering of others around us. It just happens. We are creating causes and conditions such that suffering will arise when we compare. It's a huge area we have to constantly look at and be aware of and see what we can do to change our own habits of comparing. I'll read one more thing here. This is from Joseph Goldstein, from his book Insight Meditation. Excuse me. The antidote to conceit, this idea of comparing, is to drop right back into mindfulness and to focus on the momentariness of phenomena. When our mind is caught in comparison, it is caught in a perception of self and somebody else. We enmesh ourselves in that hallucinatory conceptual framework of self and other. We make such comparisons when we do not see how everything, including the very thought of self and other, is ceaselessly arising and passing away. The contents of these thoughts trap us because we fail to see the impermanence of the thoughts themselves. Comparing mind disappears when we succeed in seeing it. So this is really just, well, here's another thing we should be mindful of. Another thing where mindfulness helps us, where the practice of mindfulness helps us see our habits of comparing. And once we see it, as he says, comparing mind disappears when we succeed in seeing it. It's just another thing we need to pay attention to and be mindful of. Both in our sitting practice, where often, you know, those stories we tell ourselves. See, next time you're caught in one of those stories worrying around in your head, how much comparing is going on? How much of it is about me not being as good as I should be, which is just a form of comparing? Or me being better than that person who was such a jerk, another form of comparing. A lot of those stories are really embedded in comparing mind. And then in your daily life, when you kind of see yourself sort of caught up in something and spinning with something, if you just ask yourself that little question, like, what am I comparing about right now? Sometimes just asking that question, you'll see, oh, a little moment of mindfulness will arise, a little hit of enlightenment will arise, just like that, just by asking that question, by trying framing what's happening with that idea. What kind of comparing am I doing right now that's causing this uncomfortable feeling I'm having? It's a very skillful thing to do in our daily lives, to when we feel like we're sort of spinning and we're out of control or something's not right somehow, it doesn't feel good. It's often because we're caught in a comparing story of some sort or other. And just seeing that often will ease it, release it, let it go. Just by seeing, oh, it's just my old friend comparing yet again. Of course, I have to read a poem to finish. So. This is from Dana Falls, one of my favorite poets. This is from her book called One Soul. Called Self-Observation Without Judgment. Release the harsh and pointed inner voice. It's just a throwback to the past and holds no truth about this moment. Let go of self-judgment, the old learned ways of beating yourself up for each imagined inadequacy. Allow the dialogue within the mind to grow friendlier and quiet. Shift out of inner criticism and life suddenly looks very different. I say this only because I make the choice 100 times a day to release the voice that refuses to acknowledge the real me. What's needed here isn't more prodding toward perfection, but intimacy, seeing clearly and embracing what I see. Love, not judgment, sows the seeds of tranquility and change.